Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
Just imagine that you're on the 13th fairway of a golf course in a small island off the northwest of England called the Isle of Man. And the weather is forecast to be absolutely terrible. It's forecast for torrential rain and gales, and the wind's just started to pick up and it's just started to rain. And I've literally just opened a new trench with, I think in the US you call it a backhoe. So we've got a digger going across, scraping away the soil. And the reason why we're there is we're there to try and find an early Christian site, essentially. The geophysics think that they've picked up a couple of burials. We're looking at like kist burials, which are stone lined. So that's what I'm looking for. And the machine scrapes back, and then all of a sudden we pick up one, and then we pick up another one. So it's all very exciting.
That's Raksha Dave, BBC host and presenter, archaeologist, and all-around badass. She's been on a lot of digs throughout her career. She's seen a lot of what British archaeology has to offer. But every once in a while, something happens that leaves her totally speechless.
The thing that absolutely blew our mind is the fact that her head was slumped to one side on the left, but on the right is a perfectly preserved plat.
That's just incredible. I have so many more questions. We'll get to them in just a moment. You've been hearing a story from our guest today, who is really fantastic. She's somebody I've been looking forward to talking to for a long time. She's an archaeologist and a TV presenter in the UK. She's currently working on projects for both Channel 5 and the BBC. Prior to that, she was a longtime fixture on the incredible archaeology show Time Team, which is one of both my and Leah's favorites. She also has extensive experience in both commercial and public archaeology. Raksha Dave, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I want to come back to something that we were just talking about there, which is kind of the continuity of people using sites over and over and over again. It's really fascinating because I think when we're thinking about past landscapes, especially in the United States, which does not have a long period of density of settlement in over most of it, the idea that people would come across something special, something that they would see something that had been there for a long time and work it into their lives can be kind of hard, especially for Americans to wrap their heads around.
Well, you say that, but I think in the US you do have that. And I've worked on a site in Texas, which was a prehistoric site. And was then also used, obviously, during kind of like the expansion, like colonial period. And they had, it was really weird. It was like a multi-period site where we had mammoths. I was excavating mammoths. Then there was this kind of like bison kill site as well. And then obviously much later on, it was then used as a settlement area in the kind of 19th century. And they had, it was like very much like a Wild West site, and there was like a store there, and they were finding kind of like bullets and beans tins and stuff like that. It was it's brilliant. So I think people do, wherever they do, congregate around particular areas. I think there is this definite kind of delineation of if there's like a, I hate to use the word ritual, but kind of like a ceremonial area or a site or something that's a special place to people that continues over millennia. It's quite fascinating to see that.
That's really interesting.
Gosh, like I was like going through kind of like the almanac of Time Team sites today, because I knew I was coming to talk to you. And I was, it just kind of struck me how many people used or continue to use these sites for what seems to be an extremely long time for different reasons. So I think we dug another early Christian site near Lindisfarne, St. Ebb's Chapel. And that was a really early Christian chapel. Again, I think it was like 7th century, something like that. And then in the 16th, 17th century, people were still going there to kind of bury their babies that were prematurely born on the periphery of that site because they weren't allowed to bury the premature babies in, you know, in consecrated ground. So finding a different use or trying to kind of be close to God, but in a different way. And I don't know, it's all very interesting.
So how did you get into archaeology in the first place?
I was just a complete geek child, absolutely loved history, dinosaurs, that kind of thing. And just, I wanted to do it. I just really wanted to do it. And I wanted to go into acting. And here, it's quite a lot of money to kind of go to drama school. And because you could get a grant, but it was quite difficult to do that. So I kind of applied and I got into a couple of places. But then at that time, you were paid to go. You could get a grant. Your education, university education would be paid for. Mm-hmm. So then I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll do archaeology to start off with. And then maybe I'll go back to that. You know, I always go back to it. I've always had that kind of notion in my head. Oh, I can always go back to that. So that's what I did. So I went to university. I did archaeology, studied archaeology. And then after I graduated, I got a job in commercial archaeology. And first job I ever had was in London, which is a great place to start because there's so much of it. There's so much archaeology everywhere. And that's what I did. I really wanted to learn how to dig. I just remember this, you know, this passion of I don't really know how to dig, but I would like to know how to.
Well, that's one of the things that's really striking to me about your experience as an archaeologist is that you have dug all sorts of sites. I mean, you mentioned that you've dug sites in Texas, that you've dug sites in London, obviously all over the UK, tons of different periods, urban sites, rural sites. Like, I mean, are there particular periods that are more interesting to you than others, or particular kinds of sites that you prefer, or do you just like it all?
I've learned to love it all. And I say that because I think it was just, it's basically through experience. So I've been really lucky. I've dug in amazing places. My first dig was on a research dig as a student in Puerto Rico. And then I went to Texas. That was in my second year. Then I graduated, started working on deep urban strat sites in London, where there's just, it's multi-period and you're excavating anything from the Victorians downwards, essentially. And then I went to Çatalhöyük in Turkey. I've dug there and there. And then I came back and then I did Time Team, where I wasn't just digging urban sites. I started digging rural sites, which is a completely different ball game. But was just an amazing education, I suppose. And so, you know, sometimes I just kind of like sit back and go, oh, did I actually do that? Oh, did I actually dig up the Queen's Garden? Yes, I did.
Well, because, yeah, that's, I mean, that's everything from the Neolithic all the way up to the 20th century. That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. And did the most amazing things, like dug the trenches for the D-Day landings, the British ones. The German one, sorry, when the British came and invaded on D-Day on Gold Beach. Dug more German trenches on Jersey for the Nazi occupation of Jersey. And also did like First World War. I've done First World War sites, like a training camp. Also a very emotional dig was when we excavated to A-26 bombers. Mm-hmm. American bombers that had crashed before they set off on a mission. So I've done it all. And just really excited about learning more, I suppose. I've always had that kind of like viewpoint, you know, do I enjoy doing it? Yes. Do I want to learn more? Yes. Absolutely.
Well, this is a show for lifelong learners. And I think everybody who's listening to this can absolutely identify with the desire to continue learning over and over and over again. Like even when you know a lot about a subject, there's always more to learn. And like, I think the more you know about something, the more inclined you are to realize how much there is you still don't know about it.
Oh, yeah. And like, you know, I did a documentary about Pompeii last year, and just being with the people who are there like year in, year out doing their own research, like, because everybody knows the story, but they don't really know that much about it. And actually kind of like watching people do their job and learning more about what actually happened, and being lucky enough to kind of latch on to learning more from them is an amazing experience.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that. You did a documentary on Pompeii. What did you learn about Pompeii that you hadn't known before?
Well, I was incredibly lucky to go and look at some of the research by Dr. Estelle Laser. She's an Australian researcher, and she's an osteoarchaeologist. And she's been looking at the casts, you know, the really kind of like famous ones that were made, the plaster ones that are kind of in the museum in Pompeii at the moment. And nobody's actually looked inside them. So we managed to CT scan them. So I was there when she first CT scanned them, which was kind of quite mind blowing. They're like, oh, do you fancy going to a hospital in Italy and CT scanning? Yes, of course. So that itself was quite interesting, because you learn about the methods that the archaeologists then used to create the casts, mm-hmm. which in itself is interesting, because I always think that archaeology reveals a lot more than people let on. Mm-hmm. So they'll write things in their notebooks and they'll publish things. But when you see the scientific analysis of something and you can actually see how something was made, it's so different from what they've written down. So that was interesting. So it's like looking at the archaeology of the archaeologists. How did they make these plaster casts? That was like absolutely brilliant. And the fact that, you know, being very Italian, they kind of like to improve them, let's say. So they've kind of like changed them, or they've given them particular appearance or look, a particular set of features. Like, for example, there's one of the plaster casts and it's called the Moor. Because they say, you know, he's got, you know, features like somebody from the African subcontinent. But it turns out it's because somebody made them that way. And actually, the skeleton, the CT scan revealed that it was actually a juvenile individual. It wasn't this, like, you know, African slave at all. It was just like a little boy who was like 14, 15 years old. It's like a very sad story. And so there's like a really famous plaster cast called the muleteer. The poet is like sat down with his hands over his face.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think I've seen that one.
Yeah. Everybody knows about that one. And it just turned out that that pose was completely doctored.
Really?
So there isn't. Yeah. So the way that they found him during the excavation was that he was actually in a fetal position on the ground. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't actually sat up at all, covering his face. So I think it's quite possible that his hands were like this. Mm-hmm. So he's like got clenched fists near his face. However, when they actually did the CT scan, there are no bones from the arms up.
Really?
From elbows up, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's kind of like conjecture. And then the bottom's kind of been added to with plaster of Paris to kind of enable, so to actually sit him up in that position. But actually that's all kind of like fake, I suppose.
Yeah,
for want of a better word.
Well, that's interesting. It's a reminder that there's always a history to the history, right? That there's the layers of time, like the people who are finding things and interpreting them and presenting them in particular ways. It's not just like a straight line from the past to the present day, that whenever you're talking about these things or interpreting them, you're always bringing yourself into them and kind of your own perceptions and needs and wants and desires too.
Yeah. So you can't, you know, it's archaeology's interpretation and so is history. Mm-hmm. You're trying to kind of make some kind of idea, thought, theory from what you have. And obviously you're going to put a bit of yourself into it. Whether that's like analytical or not. Mm-hmm. So yes, I find that interesting, seeing the differences of what people have done, what people have actually done, and you know, what they've kind of staged.
That's really interesting. Pompeii is one kind of, is one very particular kind of site, maybe the richest archaeological site of all time in terms of what's been found there. You know, what kind of, like, what can you do with different sites and what makes them harder or easier or more interesting to work on? I want to talk more about that, but first we're going to take a quick break.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
And we're back. What kinds of challenges and opportunities do other kinds of sites offer? I mean, so urban versus rural, you know, sites from different periods.
Urban sites are a bit of a specialty. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to have worked on them for like about 2 or 3 years to kind of get yourself comfortable with it, because it's kind of quite hard and fast and ready, and there's a lot of it. And you have to be able to make the right decisions, because you don't just dig in a random way. Everything is dug in a stratigraphic sequence, which basically means that you're digging the last thing that was put there by a human. And then you're kind of unraveling the jigsaw puzzle in a sequence, in a time sequence. Mm-hmm. So more often than not, you know, there's always layers of destruction and abandonment, and then rebuilding, always. So it's kind of like finding different time periods on top of time periods and different buildings on top of buildings. Mm-hmm. And it's very much like that. And just trying to get all of that jigsaw puzzle in your head can be quite difficult to interpret sometimes. But sometimes it's brilliant, because, you know, I dug a Roman site in London, which was just north of the kind of quite famous site that I think quite a lot of people know, the Mithraeum. But it was the same deposits. That it was another Walbrook site, but it was just north of, I suppose, would be the administrative centre of Roman London. So it was more kind of like workshops and residential and that kind of thing. But it was utterly fascinating, because we had the medieval directly on top of the Roman, and the medieval streets were exactly the same. They were just basically built directly on top. So again, it's that kind of continuation of spaces. That was very interesting. But then you go to a rural site and then you're like, oh, well, I'm in the middle of nowhere. And surely there's not going to be that much. And sometimes there isn't that much, but then sometimes there is, but you just can't see it. So you have to use like all of your senses, almost like the feel and the touch and sometimes the taste. I know some people who've done that. And it's quite, yeah, it's just different. And it's about getting your eye in different places. How do you interpret different things? And it's just about getting the experience. It's, you know, it's just about digging enough sites so that you know what the geology is of that area and what is happening during that period. And we always used to have local archaeologists with us, and their experience was like invaluable to us, I think, as well.
It's a reminder, like there's both breadth and depth of experience that goes into that, right? Like having a wide array of things to compare it to is very helpful, but there's also like all of those things are hyper specialized. And like, so one of the things that always fascinates me is when you have on an expert in pottery from a very particular period. So somebody who can pick out the difference between pottery produced over a 50-year period, 5 miles kiln separated by 5 miles on the road, but they're very distinctive and they can always tell.
I know because I'm married to one.
We talk a lot about pottery on my shows because pottery is interesting and you can tell a lot about pottery, but it's hard. But like, it's hard to convey to listeners if you don't have the visual aspect just how similar different like these very distinctive kinds of pottery can look to one another and just how expert you have to be to figure the difference out.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, I know what I'm looking for, and I kind of I can tell between the different time periods. But beyond that, that's somebody else's job, and I hold my hands up and I go, "What's that? Can you tell what that is? What does that mean?" You know, and that's why we have fine specialists. You know, they're important.
So I want to come back to something that you mentioned a minute ago, where you talked about digging a site that was that had been Roman and then was reused in the medieval period. And so on this show, I've spent a lot of time talking about the kind of the transition from the Roman into the medieval period. And in Britain, that transition looks very distinctive for a few different reasons. But so can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what's the difference between digging an Anglo-Saxon site and a Roman site?
I like to call Roman sites the IKEA of the archaeology world. And I know lots of people probably hit me around the head for that, but also I think Roman Britain is very interesting because I don't think it's as cut and dry as everybody thinks that it is. You know, there's this kind of like preconception that the Romans came and they conquered and that was that, and then everything suddenly turned Roman. And I always find like the edges of empire really interesting because there's kind of like this diffusion of ideas and thoughts, and you know, everything isn't as clear cut as you think it is. So in the UK, we call it Romano-British rather than Roman in archaeology, just because there's like a real mashup of buildings and structures and that kind of thing. So I've been like on sites where you will definitely have like Iron Age structures, and then somebody's gone, "Oh, did you see what Mr. and Mrs. Jones did in that field? They've got a Roman villa. I fancy one of those." So they've literally just like then, next to their Iron Age enclosures, slapped a big, massive, you know, Roman villa in the middle of their field. And they've got mosaics and fancy stuff. And so that I always find that like quite quirky and quite interesting. But kind of like transition-wise, I suppose there is, but I think that there's always been, as I said, there's always been this underlying kind of underbelly of what was there was always there and then carried on. So there's a definite time of like the Romans coming and going, but in between that, there is a complete mix. There's a mix.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I'm really fascinated by what you just mentioned with the Roman and the Iron Age in the Roman and the Iron Age continuity. Like my favorite things from kind of especially the early Roman period in Britain are like timber villas. And so that are right next to roundhouses. So like it's a villa. It's very obviously a villa because you have roof tiles and you have mosaics, but it's built in a style that is very much kind of transitional between like old Iron Age type of buildings and what we think of as a classic Roman villa. So somebody's clearly got the idea of what a villa is supposed to look like and what it's supposed to look like if you're going to be an elite Roman, but you don't have but it's not quite there. It's not quite all the way there. They're doing something a little different.
Yeah. It's a complete mashup of the two styles.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I kind of fancy that. Oh, they've got this. That looks nice. I'm going to try and make that myself. So you do have that. But then you have things that are very distinctly Roman, like the build is. And it's quite comforting, I think, to an archaeologist because you can't really go wrong with digging that stuff. You kind of know what's like going to happen. Oh, you know, it is like having, you know, the IKEA flat pack instruction manual. Yes, the screw goes there. Have you got four of those? Yes, brilliant. It is a bit like that. So you're there going, oh yes, obsig floor, mosaic walls, it's brilliant. Yeah, it's quite nice. It's not like brain dead digging. It's like pretty digging, where you can see exactly where everything's supposed to be. There's not much head scratching that goes on because you kind of know what's going to come up, I suppose. Well,
and it's easier to date very precisely too, right? Because there tends to be a lot of pottery, and we understand the pottery sequences very like pretty clearly. So you can nail it down to much narrower slices of time than you could for, say, like an Anglo-Saxon site.
Yeah, and everything looks beautiful. So you'll have, Samian pottery that's got beautiful designs on it and prints, and then especially on the London Sealed Walbrook River sites, you get all of this amazing metalwork that comes out that's beautiful, and you get bronze pins and kind of keeps you going on a really cold winter's day, and you're just like, look what I found, this is amazing. And yeah, it's nice. It's nice digging, I'm not going to lie.
I was trying to explain this years ago. I used to teach a class on early medieval Britain, and especially talking about migration into early medieval Britain. And we did a lot with archaeology and with kind of like archaeoscientific tools. So things like osteoarchaeology and analysis of isotopes. And one day, I had a student who asked me about, kind of what did Anglo-Saxons live in? And all I could think of was the contrast and like what an Anglo-Saxon site looks like in the ground, where it's just like post holes and little kind of dirt, differently colored dirt. And then you think about the Roman period, and you've got these great stone foundations, and you've got all this metalwork and pottery. And the difference between an Anglo-Saxon settlement and like a Romano-British settlement is enormous.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yes, it is.
Well, like hard to spot. Like hard to spot an Anglo-Saxon settlement in the ground.
They're actually not. I wouldn't say few and far between. They are quite difficult to find, actually. And we found kind of Anglo-Saxon halls, long mm-hmm. halls, and that kind of thing on quite a few time team sites. And you always find them in a particular area of England, actually. They always find them in the Midlands. You tend to find them more in the Midlands and obviously like East Anglia and that, the places like that. But it's a joy when you do find them, because as you say, there's just lots of staining and like lots of post holes everywhere. So everything goes back. Well, not goes back. I think it just continues into kind of like, oh, we're not going to build anything round anymore because those Romans built everything square. So let's have a go at that instead. Yeah, so it's kind of like building everything in a square rather than in the round, as it were. But it's still intensely like communal, because you have these wonderful long halls and, then you have different structures dotted around that. So just, it's all very interesting.
Yeah, there's one of the things that's really striking in talking to you now and in seeing your work is how you communicate kind of complex and technical material to a general audience. I mean, so how, like, because archaeology is a very technical field, it has its own technical language. How do you, but in listening to you talk, like, you're not using specialized vocabulary to explain it to people. So how do you do that? I mean, like, how do you translate from that kind of technical vocabulary to a comprehensible one for a general audience?
I always say that my mentor was Tony Robinson from day one, always, always. And he was always the one that used to prod and poke me and go, I actually don't understand what you're saying. Because that was the whole beauty of Time Team, was it was taking that technical language and that jargon and then translating that into something that was understandable to general audiences. So I just remember kind of, he would challenge me on a daily basis and say, can you say that in a different way? I don't know, can I? And then it really made me think, like, oh, but what does it mean? What does this mean? You know, like simple things like, what does a ditch mean? Or like a defensive enclosure, and, just things like that, things that are easily kind of brushed under the carpet by archaeologists by using jargon. Mm-hmm. So how do you then decode that and turn that into something that people can understand? So I think it's all right that you can still use the words that archaeologists use, but it's about how then do you then describe that and then deconstruct that? I think that's really interesting. On a daily basis, I don't know what you're talking about. Talking rubbish. You're talking rubbish. And now for me, that's like second nature. I can kind of decode the language and make it kind of easily understandable. But my challenge now as a presenter is how then do I then make turn that into some form of storytelling / emotional content? But now I'm like trying to find the skills of layering that up onto a different level and stretching myself to do that. So, it's a challenge on a daily basis. Well, I can still hear him on my shoulder. That's rubbish. Do it again.
See, that's something I wanted to ask about, because that last bit that you mentioned there, kind of drawing a human and an emotional connection to archaeology, which, you know, coming out of the ground, pieces of pottery, maybe bone sometimes, walls of a building. Like, how do you kind of try to tell those stories? Like, how do you put those discrete pieces of information that you're finding into a story?
I think I'm in a very lucky position where I can actually read the archaeology. So I've spent so many years reading the archaeology and then telling them into some form of narrative that I actually find that quite easy now. So it's then about then turning that narrative into the wider story. How do you then make that fit? How does then that fit into the overarching narrative of a documentary or a book or whatever? So like, for example, when I did the Pompeii documentary, they wanted to kind of highlight the story of when Vesuvius erupted and all the pumice came raining down, how bad that actually was. So we were kind of like in this closed off area that was closed off to tourists, and they're still kind of excavating those areas. And it was a beautifully kind of almost laid out for me. And I went, hang on, we can use this like pictorially to actually tell the story of how bad the pumice was when it rained down, because it's here in the archaeology. We can just look at it. And they're like, what do you mean? So they'd excavated one room, one part of the bakery, which was completely empty. They'd taken all the pumice out and they were down to kind of like the floor and the bakery, and you could see all the animals that had died in there. And then the room next to it was partially excavated, and then the other one wasn't excavated at all. That was next to it. So you very easily had this like visual of this is what it would have looked like within these small hours of it filling up and killing thousands of people. This is when people were panicking and they knew that they had to leave. And this is at the beginning of everyday normal life before the volcano erupted. So it's about kind of using those prompts and using the pottery and the archaeology that's in the ground and the deposits, and, you know, helping other people, other archaeologists, to decode their work to actually fit into that narrative. So, yeah, I can just do it. I don't know. It's just years of practice and doing it and having Tony Robinson going, you're talking rubbish. Do it again. Yeah.
So do you find when you're talking to other archaeologists, like, so you've developed these skills over many years of kind of talking to general audiences, of talking to the public. Do you find when you're talking to other archaeologists, like, they kind of naturally fit those things into a storytelling frame, or is that something that you need to kind of prompt them to do?
My job as a presenter is to help other people tell their stories. So whether that's me asking them particular questions, particular prodding questions, and then kind of moving them into thinking in a different way, that's my job. That's what I'm supposed to do. So I think that they already know those stories, but it's about how they convey those to the general public and helping them find a way to do that. So that's your job as a presenter is to help other people tell their stories. You know, I think it's not about it's not about me, it's about them. I'm trying to highlight what they're saying.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So kind of on that note, what are you working on right now? What do you got going?
There's one thing I can't tell you about, which is incredibly exciting. Incredibly. But I've just finished a series called Digging for Britain, which is on BBC Four, and that is with Alice Roberts. She's the main presenter. And it's been going on we're in the seventh series now. And I've just joined her this year, and I'm basically looking at kind of like the scientific analysis and the post-excavation part of excavation. So the premise of the show is to kind of like piggyback on other people's excavations that happened during the summer and throughout the year. And in between that, I'm actually looking at kind of all the lab work and all of the other stuff that happens afterwards. I think lots of people have this kind of like preconception in their head that archaeology is like just about digging, but that's actually like the tip of the iceberg, and all of the stories and all of the other things that happen afterwards happen during the post-excavation phase. So it's, you know, sending it off to all of those pottery geeks and find specialists and all of that kind of thing, and getting the stories and the continuation of what they found on site and the information, what that tells us about that particular site. So that's what I've been doing, and that's out in December, but I don't know if you'll get it in the US. I think you can get it, or
I'm actually not sure. I'll have to look into that and update the listeners on it. I will certainly find a way to watch that. That sounds fascinating.
it's really interesting. It's kind of looking at what other people, you know, like normal archaeologists, what they do in their day-to-day jobs, and mm-hmm. instead of, you know, being plonked in the field for 3 days, go and find something.
It's the kind of the grind of interpreting and figuring out exactly what you've got from the very exciting days of digging.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so on that note, I think that'll probably wrap it up. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you coming on and chatting with us.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Raksha Dave, it's been incredible to speak with you today. I think Leah's a little bit in love. Thank you for joining us. And you can keep up with Raksha's work on Twitter. Follow her at Raksha Diggs. Thank you for listening. From Wondery, this has been Tides of History. Next time, we'll be back with our live episode on the Reformation. So if you couldn't come see us in Boston, you can listen to it here. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Jeff Schmidt. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know, kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15, discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.